That's the Pointer Sisters and Jump. It's BBC Radio York on a Tuesday afternoon. Adam and Anna here with you through until 4 o'clock.
So next month sees the centenary of the death of Michael, Russia's last Tsar, who was murdered by the country's new Bolshevik rules, yet his body was never found. So did Michael really die?
Blimey. In a new novel, The Two Lives of Grand Duke Michael, we learn more about his life beyond 1918. Helped by Riley, Ace of Spies, he came to England to assume a new identity while still asserting his dynastic claim to the Russian throne.
But where does North Yorkshire come in? And more importantly, Filey and Scarborough. Well, delighted to welcome Nicholas Jones, who's been commissioned to adapt this book for television. Hello.
Good afternoon. How are you?
Very well. Now, obviously, this comes from a novel. So tell us a bit about the book, first of all.
Well, the book's it fits the genre of historical fiction. Think of the books of Philippa Gregory. What they do is take people who've most definitely lived, take other characters who lived alongside them, throw in one or two new people, and you get a very rich mix. You can start taking the story down different lines. But as you just pointed out, what drives this book is the fact that no body was found. Now, you may say, isn't that quite normal? Given that there was a systematic attempt to murder the Russian royal family, there was also a very concerted attempt to find where the bodies were, and this body was never found. So for a long time, it was widely presumed, not even rumoured, but presumed, that Michael had survived. He'd escaped.
So what do we know about Michael before this then, Russia's last Tsar?
Well, as you can imagine, he had quite a privileged life. He was the son of an emperor who died very young. His own brother, older brother, became an emperor quite early in life. There was a brother between him and Michael who died young. So Michael always lived in the shadow of knowing that he would quite possibly have to be emperor, but he was running away from it. He was tall, handsome, looked great in a uniform, and he seems to be a good guy. He didn't behave with any great privilege or attitude. He was particularly popular in England. He would, of course, been multilingual, and he was related, of course, to the king we had, George V. He was a cousin. But he rented a house in Hertfordshire for about a year before World War I, at 3,000 quid a year, which is quite a rent for then. I compute if a train driver was earning about £100 a year then, a well-paid job, and a train driver's probably on 50 to 60 K these days, his rent is somewhere like £1.5 to £2 million a year.
Whoa, wow.
So that's to give you an idea of the man. He's got plenty of disposable income. But there's another thing about him. He was a little bit out of favour with his much more formal older brother because he had married the wrong person. He married somebody who, by any normal standards, would be considered very well-to-do, but she wasn't royal. And therefore, he was more or less forced into exile with his wife and the son to whom they gave birth. And he just lived a wonderful life in Britain, this is a very common thing for rich people at the time. He was an early pioneer of these two new inventions called the car and the aeroplane.
Goodness me.
This is fabulous stuff.
But why would anybody want him dead? That is hard for us to understand when...
It's because, how shall I put it, the true nature of the Russian Revolution has never really come across. I mean, we can get a bit heavy and political here, but if you're taking over an old regime, as the communists were, it's a year zero thing, regardless of which country it's in. And I'm afraid that top of their agenda was to stop any attempt by the previous rulers who were royal from getting back. Now, in order for them to get their throne back, or a cousin to get the throne, they've got to still be alive physically. Therefore, it was a very early goal of Trotsky and Lenin to kill the royal family, and they started doing so in the middle of 1918. If they're dead, they can't sit on the throne.
No, absolutely. So the idea, as you said earlier on, about sort of tried and tested formula, if you like, of having people who were real mixing with other people who are real, and then you throw into the pot a really good yarn, that's what this is all about. So where...
That encapsulates it.
Yeah, so where does fact and fiction collide here then, Nicholas?
It's a very fine line. Obviously, they collide once you know that you can no longer actually prove that something you've written actually happened. But where you can say, we don't quite know for sure, that's where you've got the potential for going down your own avenues of story. We know that this, to take an obvious example, we know that this man loved flying aircraft, and therefore he would have been, he'd have been on the guest list of all the early pioneers of aircraft in Britain, because firstly, they'd B would want to fly their aircraft. B, they'd like to sell him one or sell him a nice car. These men all bought Rolls Royces by the bucket load in the Russian royal family. And of course, we had both Rolls and Royce were, I think Rolls died about that time, maybe a bit earlier. But you can imagine Henry Royce would have been beating a path to his door because someone like that. So again, I'm answering this rather long-winded way, but fact and fiction, you know this man liked Rolls Royces. Therefore, you can assume that he would have liked all the other fast cars or the smart cars of the time.
Absolutely fascinating. Stay there, because we'll come back to you and have a chat again in a few moments' time. JT Tunstall, and Suddenly I See is 25 to 3.
It is indeed. So then, next month sees the centenary of the death of Michael, Russia's last Tsar, who was murdered by the country's new Bolshevik rules, yet his body was never found. So, did Michael really die?
This is the story, isn't it?
Yeah.
This is fascinating.
Yeah, new novel, The Two Lives of Grand Duke Michael. Well, we learn more about his life beyond 1918 in this novel, helped by Riley, ace of spies who came to England to assume a new identity whilst asserting his dynastic claim to the Russian throne. So gripping is this that it's already being adapted for television by a gentleman called Michael Jones, who is with us now. Hello.
Nicholas Jones.
Nicholas, why did I call you Michael?
Because the author's called Michael.
Yeah,
perhaps. Now, this will be a twist.
Do you want to be called Michael?
Well, the funny thing is, Michael's own brother was called Nicholas.
Oh!
There's a twist, isn't it? Perhaps you are the Grand Duke. So that'd be a twist and a half.
It'd be nice. But I don't think that I've got quite the cash that they have.
We said just a few moments ago, from what you were telling us before, Nicholas, that this really does have a TV series written right across it. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's fascinating, it's gripping, it's got that thing about family, it's got that thing about deception, it's got that thing about what if. This is what TV is all about, isn't it?
The key to a novel really is to look for the main structure points. What are the bits which, if you take them out and what are the bits if you leave them in and you take everything else out, what still leave you being able to jump from one stepping stone to another to follow the story? And this, I have to say, is a very well plotted book. A lot of novels are very psychological and are obsessed with what's going through the character's mind. Nothing wrong with that. But this is very much a novel in which things happen.
And there are links to North Yorkshire in this book as well.
There are indeed. We have to remember a very interesting man who was Leeds-based called Michael Blackburn. He gave his name in due course to many famous aircraft. He also set up the world's very first airline that ran between Bradford and... Robert Blackburn ran between Leeds and Bradford, this airline. But he also used Filey Bay as somewhere to test his aircraft, because the beach in those early days, this is when aircraft were often made to land on water, and he was very taken by the beach at Filey Bay because it had great potential in the days of early aircraft to land one there. And we discovered that Michael, Grand Duke Michael, did actually know Blackburn. And again, that was par for the course for being a Grand Duke. They were natural early aviators and motorists.
So is the suspicion then that the Grand Duke spent time in North Yorkshire?
Yes. It's North Yorkshire was always, still is, very wealthy place, and it's the sort of place where a Grand Duke is likely to spend quite a lot of his time in the golden days, as they called them, before World War One.
Do we know where he stayed then, when he came?
I'm afraid I can't be that precise,
but right,
we do believe that he visited Filey Bay, and it's reasonable to assume that if he were there, he would have passed through Scarborough, because remember the Grand Hotel, which is where part of the novel is set, Grand Hotel was the hotel in Britain for a very long time. Mm.
So you're adapting this for television, mm-hmm. and you'll be looking for fantastic locations. Are you thinking that you might come up here?
Oh, very much so, yes. I mean, the North Yorkshire is a magnificent place to film in the first case, but the likelihood is that we would film in Filey Bay and at Scarborough. It's particularly key to the story that... one thing to understand about an exiled monarch is... What does he do when the bank account's been shut, or an exiled brother or monarch? You take your jewellery, packed in cases. And in this novel, Michael, this is a fictitious bit, Michael returns to Filey Bay to bury some of his family treasures.
My word.
And later on in the series, the idea is that a descendant starts looking at them. Mm. Apparently, when the Shah of Iran fell, the first thing was to get the jewellery out, because, of course, you can sell the stuff. Mm. And it's been particularly pleasing to find that the local bookshops in Scarborough, but Smith's and Waterstones and in Filey Bay, raised that they've all shown great interest in stocking the wood, because it has got that nice local appeal.
How do you adapt something like this for television?
A very interesting question, which I can never think of an easy answer to when I get asked it. You have to tell yourself the story, firstly, in a few sentences, just from memory, after reading the book a couple of times. Then you have to write it down on a sheet of paper to see if you've got the essence. If you can get those two stages right, you can then start moving into episodes and plot points and natural endings for one episode and where another one can begin. It's all about boiling what is a very large story, many tens of thousands of words in any book, boiling it down so that you can read it in a side or maybe a bit more and think, yep, I've captured the essence of the story. Once you've got that, you can then start building it back up again.
So because this has been commissioned, does it mean we're going to see it on the telly?
Would hope so. We're talking mainly more to people outside Britain at this point. I can't at this stage. We're very early days yet. I mean, yeah. The novel's only just